Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's role as a world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, we are talking about African countries taking up space in space. Satellites are going up and money is flowing into government and business coffers. But what are they there for?
The government and, you know, whichever institutions are in charge of these programs, they generate a lot of revenue. For example, in Egypt, that operate the Nilesat series of satellites, they make over $120 million in annual revenue. So this is a commercial venture, it's business, and a lot of the countries are making good revenue from that, that is contributing to economic development of their respective countries.
And why Ethiopia is launching a stock market? It's Thursday, the 26th of September. First, we go to Nairobi. Young people in Kenya have been pushing hard for change. They came out in their numbers in June to show their anger at a finance bill that raised the tax burden. Those protests quickly spread to a demand that President Ruto, a man they thought understood their struggles, resign. The behavior of the police was particularly problematic. An Amnesty International report details the deaths of six protesters and hundreds of injuries caused by police action. The investigation, backed by witness accounts and video analysis, also alleges torture and abductions. And not for the first time in Kenya. Statistics show that one in three Kenyans say they've experienced police abuse or harassment. More than 500 people have been killed by police between 2019 and 2021. These two people have been sharing their experiences of police behavior in Kenya.
The happenings during the protest really traumatized me till today. Someone was shot running beside me at the back. And the one that really got me to a point that I was arrested for it was one of my friends was hit by a tear gas canister at a close shot. I stood up for her because she was left breathless. And I just had to do something. I had to confront those police.
I was driving a car that had an issue with the tire. The case that I had was that the police would obviously threaten that you need to go and pay a fine. And in Kenya, there's a bit of a... If the police were to arrest you and take you in, they would make the process to be very, very tedious. They make it very, very difficult for you to the point where you wish you had actually paid the bribe.
Young people worldwide are subject to police abuse. Around 33% say they've been targeted by police. Civil society groups in Kenya have made plain that they will not put up with it anymore. So they tried to take a petition to the president on Tuesday, highlighting continued complaints of people being abducted and tortured by a shadowy force that operates seemingly beyond the confines of the law. Nerima Wako is a director for the civil society group Siasa Place. We've been talking to her about her concerns regarding police behavior towards people like her, especially when it comes to legitimate political protest.
Well, taking part in the protest initially in June, it was something that was organic. There was a lot of support from the public. This was one of the ones where there were a lot more people involved who are not generally within the civil society sector or within a union or workers for a specific sector. These were Kenyan citizens who are concerned about their country. So that brought a lot of people together, especially around rejecting the finance bill. What we began to see was how the protests now began to be infiltrated by goons. In the beginning, there were a lot more women. And then as the days went by, you would see a lot more men coming to the front, young men, and some of them were hired to instigate violence. So it became really unsafe. And even the amount of tear gas. At one point, one of the final protests, it was just very, very difficult to get to downtown. They had closed off the main roads, even refusing cars to pass through the CBD, and you couldn't even walk in groups of more than three people. In fact, if they saw two people gathered, they would spray tear gas at you. And so the air was just filled with tear gas. You were wearing a mask constantly, and you could see that there was a lot of intimidation as compared to before, where there wasn't intimidation. There was more standoffish stance, especially from the police.
Right.
But then now we could see a lot more force being utilized.
So those protests, you say they were organic, they were organized through social media. Can you tell us what are the legal procedures for holding a protest that requires you to interact with the police? How do you go about getting a permit should you want one for a protest?
First of all, in our constitution, under Article 37, we don't need permission from the police. You just write a letter to the police notifying them that you're planning to protest. And for them, it's to give you security as you protest, because demonstrations are our right. So there's no permission that is required. But we began to see pushback in terms of, at some point, the police said you're not allowed to. Then, of course, we're like, but you can't be giving us permission. And then it became like a warning, like if you do, make sure that you're secure, you know, take care of your own security, almost threatening that things are not going to be stable. So
can I ask you this
difference.
Very quickly? Okay. So getting a permit, as in telling the police that you're going to do a protest, and is that the same as asking for permission, or is it notifying them that this is what you want?
It's notifying them that you're planning to do a protest and their job is to provide security for you.
But can they say it's not safe to hold a protest because of this and this and this reason?
They can say that, but their job is to make sure that it is safe to hold a protest, not to wait for the violence to occur.
What is the biggest concern that you have about the police service?
Right now, we have over 60 people that have died. We have some that are missing. Even today, as I speak to you, I've lost my voice because we were submitting a letter with a list of those who have died because of their families needing to be compensated. There's no police accountability. And we're still seeing abductions happening every other day where we have masked officers who are picking up people in unmarked cars and taking them to God knows where. So there are stories of those who have returned. They're even afraid to share what happened, but there are stories of torture chambers. And we were submitting this list asking our government and the police for accountability. There are already some images of police officers shooting young people when the protests began in June.
Ruto is a murderer. Let me say this. The man who is in this office is a murderer. Ruto is a murderer.
He must go.
Ruto is a murderer.
What was the problem?
And when we had gone to those offices, this group of police, rogue police, actually showed up and they had tried to abduct Boniface Mwangi. Four other women who basically made sure that he wasn't arrested that day. They surrounded him and he wasn't abducted that day.
So your voice has been affected by the protest from June already?
No. This happened the day before yesterday. I was screaming because they had handcuffed him and they were trying to pull him away into an unmarked vehicle.
The Kenyan police over the years have been implementing many changes, including changing the name of their police force to a police service. They changed their uniform. They created a police service commission. From what you're saying, those seem to be cosmetic changes. What would you say if I said that it seems like those changes haven't changed much in the way that the Kenyan police treat civilians?
The police is still a force. And a lot of the changes have been cosmetic, but it's a concern to us that there's another entity that is roaming the streets of Nairobi and our country, abducting citizens and masked. And we know they belong to the police.
Let's talk about the police themselves and how they are treated and trained. They're not very well paid. They're poorly trained. They lack proper housing. And this can affect their motivation for service. So is there some sympathy for the police in Kenya?
It's not something that's consistent, because sometimes, because of how we see them behave, you know, the public sometimes sympathizes with them, but then there's more occurrences of them being on the wrong and the public not standing with them.
But have police been held accountable for these actions?
Most recently, not that I know of. And that's what we are pushing for them to be held accountable.
Do you think that the government currently, President Ruto specifically, has the will to actually reform the police? Because at the beginning of the protest, he did say that he was going to hold the police to account for their behavior.
He did say that, and even at the appointment of the new Inspector General, he talked about them following the rule of law and how important it is for them to do that. But what our president says and what he does, we have learned that they are two different things in totality.
Nerima Wako is the director of the civil society group Siasa Place. The Kenyan authorities are yet to respond to the Amnesty International statement. The space industry in Africa is growing rapidly. Several countries are putting satellites up there, the most recent of them being Senegal. Dakar launched its first satellite in August. The nanosatellite Gandesat 1A was developed in collaboration with the University Space Center of Montpellier in France.
They started working on it a couple of years ago, so its significance for Africa at large is not so much, because this is the 60th satellite the African countries would put in space. So this is not a new occurrence to the continent, but it's very significant for Senegal as a new spacefaring country.
That's Temidayo Onyoson, Managing Director at Space in Africa. He told me that the satellite aims to enhance environmental management, improve weather forecasting, and ensure aviation safety. The AU passed the African Space Agency Act in 2017 with the objective of coordinating and promoting space activities across the continent. More than 20 other African nations have established space programs. Countries like South Africa, Egypt, Algeria, Nigeria, Morocco, and Ethiopia. Currently, Africa has around 60 satellites in orbit, and according to a 2021 report by the World Economic Forum, data from Earth observation could unlock more than $2 billion in value for the continent. We will discuss Africa's space industry and how it can generate even more revenue, but first, let's return to Senegal. Here's Temidayo explaining why Senegal's satellite launch is so important.
I think for the government institution that set up the program, their goal is to, first of all, make Senegal a spacefaring country, which they achieved with the launch of a satellite. But much more important, the goal is to use the satellite project to build capacity, train local engineers and things like that. And I think that they achieved that with the project. It's a relatively small satellite, so there isn't a lot of value in the data that would be gotten from the satellite itself. But I think the significance is in the sense that they were able to put the Senegalese flag in space.
So what is the satellite meant to do?
It's an optical satellite. It has a camera on board, and you know, it's supposed to take imageries of the Earth, different locations, and send it to the ground station in Dakar. But in terms of actual application of the satellite data, usually data of such kind can be used in precision agriculture or even climate monitoring, disaster management, or general land use land cover studies.
Okay, I'm going to sound a little bit like a Luddite here and sort of resistant to progress and change and so on, but I am wondering, what is the value of having a satellite in space and planting your flag in space?
I think it's a matter of prestige for some country, just being able to do what, you know, other superpowers are doing. Other superpowers are launching satellites. But more importantly, I think this is tied to like the long-term plan for many countries. This is not particular about Senegal, but like for a lot of African countries, They've got a long-term plan to build local capacity in satellite technology development and be able to leverage on satellite and space technologies to address a lot of their socioeconomic problems and sustainable development. But you don't get to that stage, you know, in 1 or 2 years. It could take a decade or more.
Now, since 2022, or as of 2022, there were more than 20 African countries with established space programs. South Africa is leading with 11 satellite launches, Egypt 10, Algeria 6, Nigeria 6, Morocco 3, and Ethiopia 2. Since these countries have launched these satellites, and I know that you take a broad view of this, what benefit have those satellites been to their populations?
Let me break it into two. So most of the satellites you're talking about, you can classify them either into communication satellite or air observation satellite. The communication satellites have actually helped to, you know, improve connectivity in Africa and help with the digital divide. I can use Angola as an example. Angola launched Angosat 2, I think about 2 years ago. And, you know, the satellite is providing connectivity to rural areas. Also, communication satellites like these that are owned by Angola, Egypt, and Nigeria, they provide satellite TV broadband services. Basically, they are commercial tools, and the government and, you know, whichever institutions are in charge of these programs, they generate a lot of revenue from it. I mean, Nilesat, for example, in Egypt, that operate the Nilesat series of satellites, they make over $120 million in annual revenue, selling satellite services, you know, fixed satellite services, mobile satellite services, broadcast satellite services, and all of that. So this is a commercial venture. It's business. And a lot of the countries are making good revenue from that, that is contributing to economic development of their respective countries. The second level of satellite, you know, the air observation satellite, these have a wide range of application, and this varies from country to another. Countries like Morocco, for example, Morocco's Earth Observation Satellite is a very powerful satellite. So that has a lot of application in security, in surveillance, in border monitoring, in resource management and monitoring. The data are used for specific applications to improve industries like, you know, agriculture, urban planning and development, forest management, even disaster monitoring and all of that. So there's a wide range of applications for each of these satellites. So I think over the last 20 years, with a lot of the countries that have built and launched satellite, and especially the big players that have invested heavily in satellite technology development, they've gotten a lot of benefit from it. This is totally different for, you know, countries that are building the CubeSat, especially like the new entrants, like, you know, Zimbabwe or like Kenya or like Rwanda, Ghana, countries with like very small satellites. Those small satellites are mostly for capacity development. And this is also one of the benefits for these countries, because for many of them, they embark on these projects for technology transfer, for capacity development, you know, to be able to, you know, sort of like localize this sort of skill set in their countries. And this is working for a lot of them, you know, South Africa, Egypt, Algeria. These are some of the countries that now have local capabilities to actually build their satellites in their territory.
Now, African countries have always been interested in space exploration. I'm thinking about the Democratic Republic of Congo, or Zaire as then was. They had a project. Zambia, other countries, South Africa with Mark Shuttleworth, you know, going into near space. And the other people involved in the American Space Agency, Cameroonians, Ghanaians, and so on. So that's always been there. Is there an Africa-wide project sort of run by the African Union or something? Are African countries doing this together, or is it sort of driven by the interests of a government and the private sector, perhaps, in a particular country rather than an Africa-wide communal project?
So more than 20 countries today in Africa have their national space program. But now we've also got a continental space program called the African Space Agency. This was initiated by the African Union Commission, and the agency is now even operational in Egypt. So the aim of the African Space Agency is to bring all of these countries together to conceptualize and implement projects on a continental level, and also to facilitate international collaborations with partners.
Let's talk about some of the challenges. Money is a big thing, I'm sure. What else?
Money is a challenge, but there is also a lot of policy challenge with respect to Africa's space program. So while globally, for example, you see a lot of countries, a lot of governments taking a step back in the when it comes to technology development or program implementation, where things are now being outsourced to the private sector in order to grow the industry. This is not yet the case in Africa. In Africa, we still have a lot of, you know, government agencies trying to take the driver's seat, trying to develop the technology and all of that. And that is affecting the growth of the private sector in Africa. The other challenge is in, I would say, in the area of capacity building. For example, you know, we talked about Senegal. When countries conceptualize satellite technology development projects, and either they send students abroad for training or they even collaborate with some foreign companies to develop this technology in order to transfer capacity, what we realize is that they refuse to actually invest in local infrastructure that would help complement the whole technology transfer and capacity development process. So what you see is that when Senegal sent engineers to France, for example, to build Guyane de Sète 1, when those engineers come back to Dakar, when they come back to Senegal, there is no laboratory for them to like replicate what they've learned. So over the years, that knowledge, that training almost end up being a waste. And the next time Senegal is trying to conceptualize another satellite project, they have to repeat the same thing.
Well, for my 16-year-old niece that listens, what would you say to her are the benefits of being in the space industry?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting industry that, especially in the next decade, more opportunities would even open up with more countries trying to develop space program, with the African Space Agency becoming operational and the establishment of a lot of private companies. Of course, there are specific skill sets that are in demand, whether it's in engineering most especially. It could be mechanical, it could be electronics, even be computer engineering. There's a lot of the technical side of the industry. There's a lot of engineering elements. There's also a lot of science elements in it, from whether it's physics or atmospheric physics, geography. So for a 16-year-old that I'm assuming is probably trying to decide on what to study in the university, I think these are some really good courses to look out for.
Excellent. Thank you so much. It was really interesting talking to you.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Temidayo Onyuson, Managing Director of Space in Africa. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's role as a world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Ethiopia's economy was long a closed shop for the rest of the world. After the deposing of the Emperor Haile Selassie in the 1970s, instability and a Marxist regime as well as conflict kept the country cloistered. But that changed as Ethiopia became one of the economic powerhouses of the 2000s. Thoughts and government action turned to setting up a stock exchange where brokers and traders buy and sell company shares and other forms of paper wealth. Ethiopia is expected to launch the exchange in the coming months. But let's explore why the country did not have an exchange in the first place. Other countries in the neighborhood, Kenya and Somalia in particular, have stock exchanges. So why not Ethiopia? Hannah Tehelku is the perfect person to invite onto the program to answer that question, because she is the Director General of the Ethiopian Capital Market Authority. In other words, it's her job to educate people about stock markets and then set one up in Ethiopia. for people who don't know what the stock market is and what the stock market does, and I think I'm going to count myself among those people, what would you say it is?
I would opt with a very basic definition of stock market or capital market. Capital market is financial market where people and institutions, we call them investors, buy and sell long-term investments, which can be stocks, shares, bonds. On one side, we have investors who have some kind of money, resources, and we have, on the other hand, issuers who need some form of money, capital, to start a business or to expand their business. So it's a transaction between these two parties. So this is a market which helps businesses raise money to grow and, of course, allow investors to earn returns on their investments.
So it's literally like a physical market you can go to, and the stock can be livestock. You know, it derives from our agricultural past, right, in that sense, because the language is the same.
Yeah, that's true. You know, maybe we have also intermediaries in the normal market, but intermediaries in the capital market and stock market are, I'd say, highly regulated. For example, brokers and dealers, you have a licensing and regulatory regime in every jurisdictions you go, how they operate, highest form of integrity is required in terms of avoiding conflict of interest and those kinds of things.
How come Ethiopia, with the fifth largest economy in Africa, didn't have a stock market up to now?
It's a good question a lot of people ask. There was an effort to establish a stock market here in Ethiopia in the mid, I believe it was in the mid-1960s. But before it was formalized and before the kickoff of the formal stock exchange in Ethiopia, you know, what happened was there was a change in regime. You know, so Ethiopia's lack of stock exchange can be traced back to its historical and political context. The nationalization of private properties in the 1970s, the whole process of establishing a stock market was discouraged. So even after the fall of that regime in 1990s, it was very difficult to have a stock exchange because we have had a lot of obstacles. Even if the transition has done a lot of significant structural, regulatory, and institutional change, the lack of financial infrastructure, you know, limited financial literacy amongst our population and even our financial sectors, and of course, concerns about market stability contributed to the delay.
Not having a stock or capital market is not unique to Ethiopia. There are countries in Africa that don't have it and other countries that as well. So what determines whether a country wants or needs a stock exchange or not?
It's a very interesting question. To be honest, one thing I like about capital market is that you can't prescribe it to a country to do this or that. One thing is the country has to do its own assessment if they need a capital market or not. And the history of capital market in different jurisdictions, you can see that they used it in a way that they need it. You know, also a jurisdiction can also decide to have certain products and services that are suitable to the economy. I can give you some examples in different jurisdictions. For example, if you take maybe China, they used this entire capital market and stock market ecosystem, starting from SMEs, which are small, medium enterprises in technology, innovation, manufacturing, from using private equity, private funds, and use that as a springboard to shoot them to a listing exchange and then contribute to a larger strategic policy point of technology and innovation in the country. For example, if you take Kenya, I can say we can take REITs. It's like real estate related capital market products, and they use them to finance their housing problems. You know, some countries prefer Sharia compliant products if, depending on the percentage of their population, if they have a large number of Muslim population, they can use those products. You know, maybe you can take the U.S. The U.S. used, this capital market product to covering government expenditures. So I think the countries can decide to go that route or not, or they can choose what, you know, what products and services they choose in the capital market ecosystem.
So how will the Ethiopian economy benefit from this?
The first benefit would be businesses will have an access to capital, including SMEs, as I have told you earlier, which will give them more options to secure and long-term funding. It's vis-a-vis the traditional bank loans. As you know, as most people can understand, the bank's loan has its own, you know, procedures, rules, including collaterals and everything. But this gives you an alternative to capital growth. Apart from that, if you are listing on an exchange, the exchange might require you to adhere to a very stringent governance, you know, financial reporting, auditing standards. This will ultimately improve transparency and accountability. It will foster, you know, investor confidence in the long run. The other one would be, you know, foreign investors are really interested to invest in Ethiopia, and this will give them a room and give them a new opportunity to invest.
So explain to us the benefits to ordinary Ethiopians. Most of them don't have access to formal financial services or the education for that matter. So how can they be a part of this?
Usually when we talk about financial inclusion, it's often understood in relation to banking services, right? You know, having access to saving accounts and, you know, maybe if you can and fulfill the requirements of the banking sector to have a loan. But I feel like it's only half of the story. The capital market can provide ordinary citizens with more investment opportunities. They'll enable them to invest in company shares, which means they'll have ownership of these companies. They will benefit from dividend, making votes, and you know how they want these companies to operate. So this would enhance, you know, just the concept of financial inclusion and in the broader sense.
So what does this mean for Ethiopia's ability to access funding? The country is heavily indebted. It's just come out of a devastating war in Tigray. There are lots of parts of the country that are unsettled. Will it make it easier to raise capital for both government and for private businesses if you have a stock market?
Yes, it will benefit the government, the general public, and the businesses in Ethiopia. You know, it can diversify funding sources for the government. You know, the government can issue government bonds, which will attract, of course, both domestic and international investors. Ultimately, it reduces our reliance on external debt.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, Audrey.
Hannah Telku, the Director General of the Ethiopian Capital Market Authority. Focus on Africa was put together by Frenny Joey and Charles Kitonga in Nairobi. Bella Hassan and Yasha Michelle were on the job here in London. Nick Randell was our technical producer. The senior journalist in charge was Paul Bachibinga. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown. Thanks for listening.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.